Keywords. Samuel Scheffler's unique definition of afterlife: life will go on long after I myself am gone, and in this rather non-standard sense, I take it for granted that there will be an afterlife, that others will continue to live after I have died. Doomsday scenario: suppose you knew that, although you yourself would live a normal lifespan, the Earth would be completely destroyed 30 days after your death in a collision with a giant asteroid. How would this knowledge affect your attitudes during the remainder of your life? Main argument 1. Firstly, the reaction to the doomsday scenario: complete indifference.
So what?
It will happen after I die anyway. However, as the definition of the afterlife suggests, we accept that others will continue to live after we have died. Our confidence in the existence of an afterlife is a condition of many other things that we care about continuing to matter to us. Something that will not happen until after our deaths can still matter or be important to us. And this in turn implies that things other than our own experiences matter to us. A postmortem event that matters to us would not be one of our experiences. In this sense, the fact that we would not react with indifference supports a non-experientialist interpretation of our values. Secondly, another reaction to the doomsday scenario: few of us would be likely to deliberate about the good and bad consequences of the destruction of the Earth in order to decide whether it would, on balance, be a good or a bad thing. It is true, of course, that the destruction of the Earth would have many horrible consequences. It would, for example, mean the end of all human joy, creativity, love, friendship, virtue, and happiness. So there are, undeniably, some weighty considerations to place in the minus column. On the other hand, it would also mean the end of all human suffering, cruelty, and injustice. No more genocide, no more torture, no more oppression, no more misery, no more pain. And it's at least not instantly obvious that the minuses outweigh the pluses. Yet few of us, I think, would react to the scenario by trying to do the sums. On the face of it, at least, the fact that we would not react this way suggests that there is a non-consequentialist dimension to our attitudes about what we value or what matters to us. It appears that what we value, or what matters to us, is not simply or solely that the best consequences, whatever they may be, should come to pass. Lastly, another reaction to the doomsday scenario: profound dismay. During our lifetimes, we respond with grief, sadness, and other forms of distress to the sudden death of people we love and the sudden loss or destruction of things that we value deeply. We are bound to have similar reactions to the prospect that every particular person and thing that we treasure will soon be suddenly destroyed at once. The fact that we would have these reactions highlights a conservative dimension in our attitudes toward what we value, which sits alongside the non-experiential and non-consequentialist dimensions already mentioned. During our lifetimes, this translates into a similarly close connection between valuing something and seeing reasons to act so as to preserve or sustain it ourselves. In conclusion, our reactions to the doomsday scenario highlight some general features of the phenomenon of human valuing, which I have referred to as its non-experientialist, non-consequentialist, and conservative dimensions. We do not care only about our own experiences. We do not care only that the best consequences should come to pass. And we do want the things that we value to be sustained and preserved over time. Main argument 2. Under the doomsday scenario, in addition to our reactions of grief and sadness, to what extent will we remain committed to our current projects and plans? To what extent would the activities in which we now engage continue to seem worth pursuing? Offhand, it seems that there are many projects and activities that might become less important to us. First, our reasons to engage in them might no longer seem to us as strong. Second, our emotional investment in them might weaken. We might no longer feel as eager or excited at the prospect of engaging in them. Third, our belief that they were worthwhile activities in which to engage might weaken or, at the limit, disappear altogether. Example: to cure a cancer. This project would seem vulnerable for at least two reasons. First, it is a project in which it is understood that ultimate success may be a long way off. Even the very best research that is done today may be but a step on a long road that will lead to a cure only in the indeterminate future, if at all. The doomsday scenario, by cutting the future short, makes it much less likely that such a cure will ever be found. Second, the primary value of the project lies in the prospect of eventually being able to cure the disease and to prevent the death and suffering it causes. But the doomsday scenario means that even immediate success in finding a cure would make available such benefits only for a very short period of time. This suggests that projects would be specially vulnerable if either, A, their ultimate success is seen as something that may not be achieved until some time well in the future, or B, the value of the project derives from the benefits that it will provide to large numbers of people over a long period of time. The effect of the doomsday scenario on other types of projects is less clear. For example, many creative and scholarly projects have no obvious practical aim, such as finding a cure for cancer. Would artistic, musical, and literary projects still seem worth undertaking? Would humanistic scholars continue to be motivated to engage in basic research? Would historians and theoretical physicists and anthropologists all carry on as before? Perhaps, but the answer is not obvious. Not only about those projects mentioned above, to the perspective of our more routine ways of life, there are still questions to answer. Would people still be as motivated to have children if they knew that those children would die no later than 30 days after their own death? It seems unlikely that they would. But if they would not, then neither would they be as motivated to engage in the wide, varied, and life-altering array of activities associated with raising and caring for children. By contrast, the projects and activities that would seem least likely to be affected by the doomsday scenario are those focused on personal comfort and pleasure. But it is perhaps not altogether obvious what would be comforting and pleasant under doomsday conditions. Therefore, the existence of the afterlife matters more to us than our own continued existence. It matters more to us because it is a condition of other things mattering to us. Without confidence in the existence of the afterlife, many of the things in our own lives that now matter to us would cease to do so or would come to matter less. In conclusion, the afterlife matters to us, and in more than one way. What happens after our deaths matters to us in its own right, and, in addition, our confidence that there will be an afterlife is a condition of many other things mattering to us here and now. Main Argument 3. Granted, it is not surprising that people should lose interest in a goal-oriented project once it is known that the goal of the project is unachievable. What may be surprising, however, is the fact that people are often happy to pursue goals that they do not expect to be achieved until after their own deaths. What the doomsday scenario highlights, in other words, is the extent to which we regard projects as worth undertaking even when the successful completion of those projects is not expected to take place during our own lifetimes. What is significant about the example is what it reveals, not about the familiar role of instrumental rationality in our practical deliberations, but rather about our willingness to harness the resources of instrumental rationality to pursue goals whose achievement will occur only after we are gone. In conclusion, the doomsday scenario highlights some of our attitudes toward time. References: Samuel Scheffler, Valuing, Inequality and Tradition, New York, Oxford University Press, 2010, Chapter 1, pages 15-40. David Lewis, Dispositional Theories of Value, in Papers in Ethics and Social Philosophy, Cambridge, Cambridge University Press, 2000, 85. Citation. 1. Death and the Afterlife, Samuel Scheffler. Access, https://bok.cc/book/2344781/ab771b or contact me.